Mack Weldon makes high-tech men's underwear out of silver. Yes, the metal, woven right into their undergarments. Why? Because it's antimicrobial, which means it eliminates odor and wicks away moisture, which gives you the psychological comfort that you could, if you wanted to, wear any one of their undergarments every day for a week. It would still smell like the day you put it on. Don't do that. But if you are flying in a hot air balloon nonstop around the world, get some Mack Weldon. They make the best underwear, socks, and shirts for every occasion. And shopping for their stuff on their website is simple and easy. And if you don't like the first item you buy, you can keep it, and they will refund you no questions asked. Go to MackWeldon.com right now and get 20% off using the promo code SOSMART. Mack Weldon, smart underwear for smart guys. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart Podcast, episode 81. Good morning.
Hello, David.
How are you?
Just fine, thank you. Excellent.
Well, thanks for setting some time aside. Yeah. Let me go ahead and get this out of the way. How do I pronounce your name?
Per Espen Stoknes, or anywhere else close to that.
So if I say Per, that's okay?
That's what I usually do when I'm in the U.S., yeah. Just okay. Call me Peter. Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I'm...
This is an interview I did a while back with Per Espen Stoknes. He's a psychologist in Norway who wrote a book titled What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming.
I'm Per Espen Stoknes. I'm professorship at Norwegian Business School. I teach green economics, and also I'm a psychologist in background. So I also consult within climate communications and written a new book on this topic.
As I've mentioned on the show before, I'm researching and writing a new book about how people change their minds and why they don't, and how you can change other people's minds, and how individual mind change scales up to social change. And Stoknes was one of the first people I interviewed because he put together this strategy for science communicators who find themselves confronted with climate change deniers. And of course, he also is trying to help scientists who find themselves in that weird situation where they are dealing with people who don't believe that they are experts on this topic. They don't believe that they actually know what they're talking about. They are denying them. They deny the fact that they have any evidence whatsoever that climate change is real. So he's developed a psychology-based strategy for working with people like that. And I thought it was incredibly interesting. And since I'm on the road right now, I thought for this episode, I would just present what he had to say when I interviewed him about that strategy and the guidebook he published on it last year.
Yeah, this is what I call the psychological climate paradox. The paradox is really that since 1989, that's 26 years now, the amount of scientific facts and the certainty of the science has been growing very strongly. So we had like 5 IPCC reports and more than 30,000 new climate science articles published, which all underline the seriousness of the problem. But if you look at the polls, the weird thing happens is that since 1989, people's concern for climate change has actually declined. This psychological climate paradox is particularly prevalent in wealthy democracies such as the US, Canada, UK, Norway, Australia, which are both like to see themselves as rational, modern, and but also petroleum-based and economies. So what I've done is to really condense the, let's say, the 300 or 400 articles that have been published within psychology and sociology and social anthropology into a set of psychological barriers that create this paradox. So there are psychological barriers inside us, or mechanisms that come into play when there is, shall we say, an uncomfortable science message that's coming our way.
So you, early on in the book, you write about how there is a sort of a golden rule to psychotherapeutic approaches. And you talk about how when we have something that seems like it's been a solution in the past, something like a habitual solution, that we can use it so often that it becomes part of the problem. And we end up doubling down our efforts when facing difficult problems instead of trying to go about moving to a different course. Could you sort of elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's kind of quite common, as you say, within coaching and psychotherapy, that if you have a problem, you try harder the way you have tried to solve it. But then gradually what you do is, by pushing harder and harder, you're just reinforcing the problem, because you're doing something that also contributes to the problem. And this has been the case in terms of climate science communications. Because there has been this conviction that if only we could get the facts out to people, then they would kind of come to their minds and senses and recognize that this is important or this is serious. However, having tried that and seen that it didn't have the intended effect, what has the climate science communicators done? Well, they're doubled their efforts and put a little bit of doom and apocalypse into it. If we don't change our ways now, we're on our way to a 4-degree plus, or even worse, a burning world. But for them, as rational messengers, rational scientists, they wouldn't say like burning world or toast world. No, in the IPCC report, they come up with an incredibly communicative name of RCP 8.5. And this is one example. You know, by sticking so hard to your science that you tend to forget that you're actually trying to reach out to people, and it gets the opposite effect of what you intended, which is that people distance themselves from it and are turned off.
So, I mean, you see a lot of these videos. I remember something that went around on the internet a while back. It was a clip from HBO's The Newsroom, where they had the climate scientists saying that we're all doomed and everything. And I think that stuff, I would speculate that sort of thing is really sort of a dog whistle effect. So that, like, all the people who are already on your side, they are the ones who watch that kind of stuff and read that kind of stuff and say, look at this, and they share it around on their social networks. But among the people who are opposed to this or deny it or for whatever reason feel like that this is not a message that they accept, that just bounces off of them and becomes evidence for how crazy the other side is. And so that's sort of the gist of what I see in a lot of what you talk about in this book. So if this rational strategy, you know, our quote unquote rational strategy doesn't work, this confrontational thing doesn't work, this sort of shoving the facts down people's throats doesn't work, why doesn't it work? And what is a better, broader alternative to just saying, look at this fact?
Exactly. So in a way, when the scientists have been pushing facts at people, it's been repeating the same experiment over and over and seeing that it has the same outcome, but not being willing to change how you do it. So the principle then is we should do something else. We should try something else than just pushing the facts. Mm-hmm. And the reason it doesn't work is that those who are, as you mentioned, ready to take it in, they have already heard. So you could kind of segment the population into six main groups, if you will. Some say they are alarmed, and this is about 13% of the population, and they have heard and they have understood. Then there are a, a group called The Concerned, which are like 31%. They're also quite convinced, but even if they want a more vigorous policy, they're somewhat less involved in the issue. And then you have the rest of the population, which then adds up to typically a little bit more than 50%, who are either cautious, disengaged, doubtful, or downright dismissive of the whole issue. So among these other groups, the 13%, the 87%, quite a few psychological barriers, as I mentioned, are involved in creating this negative impact from climate science on people's concern. And I give these names that all start with D, just for the kind of simplicity.
Sure. Let's go through these. These are really cool. These are the five D's of climate.
Not really denial. No,
denial's in there. The five D's of how would you put it? How would you put it?
Yeah, it's the five psychological mechanisms that kind of uphold the psychological paradox of the climate. That we, the more facts we get, the less concerned we go. And the first of these is, as I briefly mentioned, distancing, because when we hear about climate change, it's typically positioned in the year 2100 or 2200. Like, you know, you've maybe heard the news that Antarctica is now melting. There's no way it's going to be stopped. And in 200 years, there will be more than a meter of sea level rise. Well, when people hear that, they think 2200, did you say that? And it's so way out distance beyond what people care about in their ordinary lives, which is like this month or this week, that the issue importance kind of just goes down compared to the other more pressing stuff we have on our to-do lists. So there's the distance in time, and there's also distancing in terms of social or the space, where when typically they've been using a lot of imagery of melting ice and polar bears and the flooding in Bangladesh or cyclones in the Pacifica. And all these images are very distant in space from us. So it's happening far in the future and it's happening far away from me. And thirdly, the people who are typically suffers the consequences of climate change, they're people I don't really know. They're socially distant from me. I don't know them. I don't know the even know somebody who knows them. And this social distance, so to speak, creates a lowering of concern, particularly if it's said like, 1 million people were displaced by the storm. But we know that people don't really relate well to statistics such as that. One person is a tragedy, but 1 million is statistics. And we have yet another way of distancing ourselves from it, and that is in terms of responsibility. When we hear about politicians and negotiators and all these international COP rounds, like we'll have another one now in Paris in this December coming up, but we had them before, like in Copenhagen, Warsaw, Lima, etc. And what we hear is that people who we don't know stand up and say, we must act now, and then everybody agrees that the only thing they agree on is that they will meet again next year. And so it's outside my scope of influence, so to speak. That's a psychological concept. I can care and do something about what I have a kind of self-efficacy in the terms of if I do it, it will have an effect. But with these negotiations that are so far removed from me and responsibility, it just creates helplessness and I want to kind of give up feeling. So the first barrier is very important in terms of creating this reduction in the sense of urgency and in the sense of felt risk or and concern.
It seems so strange though, because I mean, we have all these, there are all these mechanisms of distance when it comes to this issue, but it seems like, you know, everywhere I am being affected by climate. Every, like it's a persistent part of our day-to-day lives, yet it's strange that we would find, feel a psychological distance from the actual issue. Is part of the problem that people sort of conflate weather and climate as being the same thing, you think, maybe?
It's an interesting point you mentioned there, because people tend to get more concerned about global warming when there's been a hot period. And if there is a cold period, then the concern falls. And this is even statistically reflected in news media and the types of articles that are published. So the number of editorials and the number of articles about climate change, they go way up if there's a heat wave. And then when it goes cold, they go way down. So this just shows to me how dominant, psychologically speaking, in our attention, what is that the near takes predominance mm-hmm. of the more distant or the long term.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to doom. This is, it would seem like, on the surface here, it would seem like these messages of doom would get people to act, but it, you say that it actually ends up backfiring. How does that work?
Yeah, well, as the framing, so to speak, of climate message has been that if we continue as today, we'll all end up in a burning planet or in hell, if you will. Mm-hmm. And this doom and apocalypse framing sets up a state of mind where we are felt somewhat guilty. There's a certain fear in it. And what is quite well known to psychology is that if people feel fear and guilt, then they're not really motivated to get engaged. Rather, they quickly learn what we call avoidance behavior. So on the one hand, we do habituation to it. We heard it so many times before. It seems like it's always the end is nigh, always the last times. And then if we feel any fear and guilt still after that, we tend to get pacified by it. We do not get active and want to do something with it. So fear and guilt is good at making people want to avoid the messenger and the message. And we quickly learn how to filter it out. So that's the problem with using doom as the main framing for a climate message. It backfires very quickly on the issue.
And now a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all included with your Squarespace website. Creating your website with Squarespace is simple. It's intuitive. You can add and arrange your content and features with the click of a mouse. And you get a free custom domain if you sign up for a year. Use their beautiful templates to design a best-in-class online store, and you don't have to use a single plugin to get Squarespace to do the cool things you need a website to do. They also offer seamless commerce tools. Nationally recognized brands use this. Hundreds of thousands of shop owners use this. You can track inventory, process orders, send custom emails, all from the same intuitive interface. And customer support is 24/7. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter the offer code SOSMART to get 10% off of your first purchase. Squarespace, set your website apart. And now we return to our program. I'm David McRaney. This is the You Are Not So Smart podcast, and we're listening to sort of a raw interview with Per Espen Stoknes. We're going to get right back to where we just left off.
That's interesting. And I've read there are similar effects when it comes to dieting and exercise. Like people can, you think that messages that say you're going to get fat or messages that you're going to die of heart disease, you're going to, even when, when it comes to smoking, those messages.
Exactly.
It seems like those are going to work on people, but really what it does is it just, it creates that situation that you were describing where people will just simply find a way to rationalize away what they're wanting to do in the first place, because we're very, very good at that. So
exactly. That brings us up to the third barrier, so to speak, which is the dissonance barrier. Mm-hmm. So these are somewhat distinct but also somewhat connected. So if we get through the distance barrier by saying that the climate change is here and now and making it kind of visible to people, and then if we manage to avoid the doom barrier, which is deeply pacifying to people, and then thirdly, we hit typically the dissonance barrier. And the reason for this is that one, what we do conflicts with what we know, mm-hmm. then this generates a type of uncomfortable feeling inside of us that psychology is called the dissonance. It's really from, like you said, with smoking. If I know that I smoke, and I also know that smoking kills or smoking leads to cancer, this generates some, yeah, uncomfortableness, unease, something that's not quite right in terms of my self-image, because I like to see myself as a good person. And then quite a few of creative strategies are typically employed to kind of get rid of this dissonance. Mm-hmm. So our brains are very creative when it comes to coming up with good justifications, so we don't have to really bother too much about this dissonance, or we'll get rid of it. So, for instance, we could say that if I smoke, to do that example first, I can modify one by saying, I really don't smoke that much. Actually, my friend smoked even more than me, so I'm probably fine. Mm-hmm. I can also change the perceived importance of one of them. I could say, well, actually, the evidence is quite weak that smoking causes cancer. You know, I have this aunt, she smoked, you know, 40 a day, but she's fit as a fiddle. And then I had my uncle, he actually died of cancer, but he never smoked. So, you know, it can't be that clear or that strong. So by telling myself this, I kind of reduce the felt dissonance. And what we're seeing now in climate is that we're having this the same type of responses. So if I have like two contradictory elements between what I do and what I act, do and what I know, such as I have high emissions, I live a high energy, fossil fuel energy intensive life, and secondly, CO2 leads to climate change or climate disruptions. Well, this generates, in the same way as we're smoking, this dissonance. Mm-hmm. And then, how can I get rid of that? Well, I could use the same strategies as a is used in terms of smoking. I can say, well, my emissions are really quite insignificant. It's there. It's the Chinese, or it's the Kuwaitis, or it's the Indians that are now, you know, making all these things. They're emitting more than we are. So that helps a little bit, and that's been used to a certain extent. Excuse me. And then we could also change the importance of one cognition, saying that, well, the evidence is quite weak that CO2 causes warming, really. I heard from one scientist who says it's the sunspots. And this is an interesting point, because when people, I mean, there has been a well-funded and well-oiled misinformation campaign, right, with the big oil money paying for a lot of these messages that mm-hmm. climate change isn't really happening, or it hasn't warmed since the year 1998. And with very little brain power and very few facts, they're able to kind of get their message across. And one of the reasons why this is that there may be a kind of demand side to this disbelief. So we have a supply and we have a demand side. And the demand side is really generated by this dissonance feeling. Because if I then really start to question or doubt the evidence, well, it makes my dissonance go away, doesn't it?
Right.
Also, I could, you know, do more things like this. As you mentioned, with dieting or smoking, I can say that actually I've now installed a heat pump or a solar panel on my roof. So my trip to Thailand now doesn't really matter. I've come to that.
Right.
In psychology, we call that strategy for moral licensing. Because I've done one good thing, I can now do continue as usual, so to speak. And then, if this dissonance goes back and forth, you know, I try to explain it away, but it doesn't really go away, and it comes back, and then I maybe have a friend who confronts me, or I hear again, read again some news, some of the science. I can also be tempted to kind of end up with just completely, simply denying that the cognitions are related. I can say there is no evidence linking CO2 and climate change. And then I would have to add some story to kind of justify that. And I could say, for instance, that, well, this is just the left side. Now that Marx is dead, they need another excuse to make a bigger government or put up the taxes. Or these climate scientists are just screaming because they want to have more government funds for their own research. So by making these kind of stories, I'm able to let my dissonance go away. And that feels better, mm-hmm. feels good. So this is part of the backlash, part of the reason why that since 1989, because we haven't had behaviors, actions that are consistent with what we know, this creates the dissonance, and then the dissonance is done away by these simple psychological strategies that, you know, right. makes us feel better.
And then your fifth D is identity, which is sort of, and I'm assuming this is more along the lines of, you sort of have a social construct of who you are, yourself, and everything, and then you have this network of people that your very identity as a human being and your social network could come into threat if you were to flip on this issue. What would other people think, and how would you realign yourself? Is that more in line with what you're thinking?
Exactly, because if my sense of self and my lifestyle, my professional self, that is my job, etc., are threatened by news or facts or some messenger, then I inevitably encounter resistance to take that in, and I prefer to shoot back at the other to protect myself or my self-esteem. So maybe the simplest example of this is a new trend in the US that I found. You know, cars are typically expressions of ourselves, you know, mm-hmm. the brand of car and how you drive it, and you know. So if you have a big SUV with a truck with a diesel engine, and then there comes this enviro guy maybe driving his Prius or electric car, and it comes up into your bumper or maybe or gets a bit too close, and you feel, huh, what is he doing here? Mm-hmm. And then there's become a market for this. It's called rolling coal, which is a piece of equipment you can install in the engine. So when you hit the button on the dashboard, it injects more diesel than the motor can do. And suddenly you can make a huge cloud of soot and carbon and just drown out that Prius right behind you. So this product is called the Prius Repellent, and it's on sale for about $500.
That's amazing.
Yeah, isn't it? So it just shows the extent of identity protection, how that works. Yeah.
So I'm thinking, okay, so the kind of person that might buy that, or people of all stripes that are on the side of, I don't believe in global warming, I don't believe in human, you know, anthropogenic climate change, people who don't believe that and all that stuff, it seems so weird to me, the people that are in the throes of all these psychological mechanisms you describe, if you were like, let's say you were in in college and you were listening to a scientist talk about volcanoes or a scientist talking about how mosquitoes, the life cycle of a mosquito. There's all these, there are many different things that people will hear about in the world of science that's, you know, beyond their layperson understanding. But when they hear scientists and experts talking to them about that sort of thing, they accept that this person is an expert. They accept that they don't really understand this fully, and this person does, and they will take that person's advice. Why is it on this issue that people suddenly stop and say, I don't know about that? It seems like a strange thing. It seems strange to go, I don't know about all those thousands of experts on this topic. I think I know better than them. Why is this a sticking point for people and other scientific ideas or not?
Yeah. When you hear some expert talking, then we typically want to know a little bit about what's his identity. Is he in my tribe, so to speak, or is he from somewhere else? And studies have been done that show if the expert holds the same values, for instance, religious or in terms of politics, then I tend to trust that expert more, even if it's a fake expert. So this identity protection, this last barrier, wants us to kind of cherry pick or select what kind of experts we are willing to listen to when the issue has been politicized. And that's what happened with the climate issue. Since it's become an identity issue, it's now more, you know, it's now more polarizing in politics than even abortion or gay rights and guns. So in this case, when the issue has been politicized, then suddenly we start to screen the values of the expert before we make up our minds. And this is the way that identity protective cognition actually works. I prefer to give more weight to maybe one expert who has the same values as me than 1,000 who seem to have opposing values.
Mm-hmm. It's really strange. You know, you can imagine, I can imagine, I think if this hadn't happened, it would seem so bizarre, because it would seem like strange. Like, imagine if like astronomy became politicized, and that there would be like that person's in the out group. I'm in this in group. I don't believe there is a Jupiter. I don't care what you show me. Those are all faked. I mean, it's so amazing that something that is purely empirical, and for the most part is just a bunch of numbers and charts and graphs, can become infused with these political values and then put people in their camps. It seems so strange. And the idea that it could happen to this scares me, because I think, well, maybe that could happen to any scientific principle. And it has in the past, of course. And the fact that it's happening to this right now is a real, for a lot of people, it's a real conundrum. And you write, you identify these, your book is fantastic because you identify all five of these things, and you sort of lay the foundation before that. But then you have some real practical advice on what we actually should be doing instead of what we are doing now.
Exactly.
We have, before we run out of time, let's go into what are some things that we can do to counteract these psychological mechanisms?
Great. Yeah, let's talk about solutions. First, knowing these barriers help you define your success criteria for better climate communications. So you can kind of flip them over to see whether new types of climate communication actually will be hitting the barrier, or can maybe help us move past it, move beyond them. So the first is to make climate issue feel more personal, more near and urgent. That's the distant, you break that one. You can also do that by making it more social, which I'll come back to. And then the doom barrier have to be bypassed by using framings that do not backfire on the issue through negative feelings. And thirdly, we need to reduce the dissonance by making it easier and simpler for people to do visible and consistent actions. And fourthly, we have to avoid the emotional need for denial, which is the feeling of being accused and in guilt. And fifthly, we have to reduce the cultural and political polarization on the issue by better storytelling that embraces values of other segments of the population. So in summary, I've given these new strategies the names starting with S, just five here too. There are social, simple, supportive stories and signals. Mm-hmm. So if you want, I can just dive into the first one, which is the social network strategy. We have to make the climate message more social because, as I said, if you only talk about glaciers and Arctic ice or polar bears or Bangladesh or Pacific Islands, it's way, way far from me. But if it's something that happens in my network with something that people that I care about, then suddenly it feels much more near and more personal and more urgent too, because it's here and now in a way. So I have a few examples of how this works. Some communities are trying to get out of the gloom and starting to do more like parties and get-togethers and having fun together when they do local community issues, such as sports games. You might have heard of the Green Sports Alliance. They do like the greening of sports events. And then the sports stars, or the people that you look up to, the sports people, they get influenced through peer messengers that are much closer to themselves. than a distant climate scientist. But also ordinary neighborhoods, such as if there's one neighbor who puts up solar panels on his roof, then suddenly the likelihood of the others in the same area goes way up. So you could say initiatives such as rooftop solar is contagious. And people don't do it because of the climate, but because they see that others are doing it as well.
Right.
And this came very clearly out of an experiment that was done by a professor called Bob Cialdini, who put up hundreds of households into four groups. And the first group were told they should conserve power for the sake of sustainability. It's good for the earth. And the second group were told they should conserve energy because of their children and their children's children, and the future generations. The third group were told they should conserve energy because it's profitable. You save money by cutting your power bill. And the fourth group were told how much they are using compared to their neighbors. The very clear message was that the most motivational message was the one where I could compare myself to what my neighbors were doing. Mm-hmm. And this is what we call using the power of social networks. And you might have heard of the company OPower, because they've taken this research and then leveraged it into a business idea. And so now you can get your power bill, on your power bill, you can get a comparison to your efficient neighbors and to all neighbors.
Right.
And then if you're doing better than them, you get typically two smiles and great. Or if you're in the middle, you get a good and a smiley. And if you're below, you don't get any frown because they don't use frowns.
Right.
You have to be on the positive side. So Cialdini's point is that people just don't want to conserve energy. They want actually to be acknowledged for conserving energy. And this little twist is what makes the whole difference in terms of motivation to do something about it. We call this using the power of social norms, because if I believe that other people whom I care about or are in my network do something with it, then I will do so too. And the opposite, if I believe that nobody's taking action on this, then I won't bother either.
Right.
And by then having people see that, for instance, like sports events or solar panel spreading or solar panel clubs or making your power consumption visible either through an app or text messaging or the bill, all these things adds up so that you shift the baseline, so to speak, of what is considered the social norm or the typical ways. If I'm in doubt what to do, then I will ask, what would other people do in my situation? And then I would typically do what I believe most other people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
This has to do with the extent to which we humans are social imitators. And that goes way back into our evolutionary psychology. Mm-hmm. We're very good at that.
And now a word from our sponsor. I love learning just for the pure pleasure of it, and that's why I'm a big fan of the Great Courses Plus video learning service. They have more than 7,000 engaging video lectures presented by top professors on so many topics, and you can subscribe to the Great Courses Plus to get unlimited access to all of them. Watch all that interests you anytime. Now, I recently watched their popular course, The Inexplicable Universe, Unsolved Mysteries, presented by astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. And if you loved cosmos, this is a deeper dive into the heart of some of science's greatest mysteries, including extraterrestrial life, multiple universes, string theory, what it means for life to be intelligent if we then find life and think that maybe it could be intelligent. I love this course because it's about what we don't know about the universe. And for a limited time, you can watch a lecture from The Inexplicable Universe absolutely free, no strings attached. But you can only get this limited time offer by going to, here it is, thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. So watch this free lecture today by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. And now we return to our program. And now the conclusion of our interview with Per Espen Stoknes.
So your next frame is about being supportive, about making sure you employ frames that support your message.
Right. And as we mentioned earlier, the doom frame tends to backfire. And another similar frame that has been used by economists is that it's so costly to do something about the climate. So it's very expensive. And if you say it's not costly, you're still activating that framing. So what's emerging are new main supportive frames is, first of all, the health framing. Because if you state that climate change is really about the health of people, because it increases pollen allergies, asthmas, heat-related violence, heat-related heart strokes, more infectious disease, all these kind of things, mental health problems that are here right now, then it's like this aligns with what people consider to be the most important political priorities. Let me explain briefly. If you ask people, the public, what are your most important public priorities or the problems you think politicians should face, should do something about, then what always comes out on top is the economy, health, education, jobs, these kind of issues. And climate gets way down below there to maybe 19 out of 20 or something like that, 14 out of 15. But since health always is one of the top issues, by aligning climate with health, you use that as a frame to make it felt important go way up. So quite a bit of research has shown that if you frame or talk about climate in health issues, health terms, then there's a willingness to support it goes up. And it seems Obama has learned or heard this research too, since now he's going to arrange a climate change and health summit quite soon at the White House. And he's involving the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Murthy, for instance. Another frame that we know works well is the risk or the insurance frame. So rather than discussing just the costs of the investments, we should discuss how much are we willing to pay today to avoid a larger risk in the future. Now, this is what the insurance industry is all about. And today, we are, for instance, willing to pay in the order of 2 to 3% of our entire GDP in fire and theft insurance. But we hardly pay, we pay more or less zero in terms of climate insurance. And that's the absurdity of it. So if we realize that just as defense is also a typical this kind of risk issue, we pay for having a strong defense in case something happens. We don't really believe that America will be invaded or that kind of stuff, but we need a strong defense because we might experience a war again.
Right.
And in the same way, we could argue that we don't really know that the world is going to burn up, but it is a risk, and we should insure ourselves as we do with defense and fire insurance against that for happening. It's just plain common business sense. It's prudent. And this has been put forward in a kind of a report written by both Republicans and Democrats together. I'm thinking about Hank Paulson and Tom Steyer, for instance. They went together to make a report called The Risky Business. And they just spell out the risks to business as if we do not insure and pay certain climate investments today.
To me, it seems like if there was a 1% chance that all of this is true when it comes to global warming and climate change, then we should probably do something about it. Yet we know that the percentage is way, way higher. So it feels like that's a really, really good way to go at it, is saying like, look, the chances, no matter what the chances are, we should do something. You know, we make movies about having asteroid defense systems and things.
Yes.
Like
that. So
this is an actual thing that our scientists have come to us and said, hey, do something about this.
Yeah, so that's one frame that's very, very important to use. Not speaking about as expensive, but speaking about as investment in insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an even better frame as well to kind of get a more less polarization and more bipartisanism here, and that is the opportunity frame. Mm-hmm. But and this has to do with all the opportunities for that arise with a new energy system, a new city infrastructure, and smart houses and smart cities and maybe smart even roads. I don't know if you heard about the solar roadways idea. It came up last year and on Indiegogo, a crowdsourcing website, and it went really viral because it showed people an opportunity that they liked so much that they put more, they gave away more money into this startup than any other has achieved in the history of crowdsourcing. It's, what it really does is it says that we could make smart roads by building solar panels into them and then some LED indicators, and you could have roads that are generating more energy than they need and at the same time showing if alarm signs on the road if something is happening further down, and they can redirect traffic and all these opportunities. Mm-hmm. So what would it really be like to have smart roads and not just dump asphalt roads? And people love this concept. So it just speaks to the power of opportunity in this area. I'm not saying it's a great economic idea that it will be profitable, but I'm talking about the psychological aspect, how people were fascinated about this.
Right.
So, yeah.
And so these, you know, these things can get so complex. You say that it's important. One of your big principles is it is important that we try to make sure that this is that whatever we're asking people to do is simple and easy and not a giant sort of undertaking on part of the individual. Could you sort of elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. If you walk into some kind of store and then you want to do a climate-friendly purchase, and it has like 80 different brands on the aisles, or if I want to buy some household appliance and I wonder which one would be the best in a long-term point of view, it's really hard to pick the right products. So what we could do is to apply some principles from behavioral economics to make it much more simple to do what is right. You know, people make a lot of mindless and destructive choices because that's the way we have the economy set up. But the good news is that we could do a lot of mindless and constructive choices instead. So we tested out one example that's pretty easy to explain is the use of defaults. So let's say, for instance, that you you put all printers into the default of double-sided printing. So if you don't specify anything, it comes out double-sided. Mm-hmm. And that would save something like 15 to 20% paper, equivalent to taking 150,000 cars off the road if it was applied to all U.S. offices.
Wow.
And that's just a digital switch. And also, we did one study in Norway where we put life cycle cost on the household appliance. So when you walk into a store, you can immediately see what this will not just cost me today as a sales price, but it will cost me over 7 or 10 years of use. And suddenly, maybe the washing machine, the air conditioner, or the tumble dryer that is the cheapest today, you see with large fonts the costs over 7 to 10 years. So the nudge here is really to redesign the choice architecture or the layout of the label so that the life cycle cost is printed with large fonts and the sales price with somewhat smaller fonts on the same price label. Mm-hmm. And this had the effect that people started buying the more energy efficient appliances because they were cheaper in the long run, but that, they hadn't just known that before. And suddenly, on average, people were buying 5% more, or they were buying household appliances that would reduce their power consumption by 5%. And if this was applied to all household appliances in the EU, we calculated, it would be equivalent to 10 million tons of CO2, or like taking 2 million cars off the road. And this is the effect just by redesigning the price label.
Mm-hmm. And so, and another huge aspect of this, and this is something that I've seen come up a lot, especially in PR circles is that you really have to attach some sort of narrative to this, some sort of,
yeah,
if you need to give people the opportunity to understand this in a story format, because we seem to really prefer to receive information in that format. So what are some ways you've seen that this works when it comes to the issue of climate change, global warming, that sort of thing?
Yeah, what I'm liking now is that there's a new narrative or story emerging among both consultancies and business leaders on this that has to do with the resource productivity improvements, or what some call the resource revolution, another call the circular economy, because it takes the story of, let's say, the 20th century was all brown growth. We grew our economy by cheap fossil fuels, but now the age of cheap fossil fuel is over, and we have to accommodate many billions more of middle-class consumers on this planet. And we tell this story now how this is going to happen through radical resource efficiency. So we can do much more with much less. And this is a narrative that applies specifically to business leaders and people who are focused on opportunities. On the other side, to other segments of the population, maybe religious people or people who are more engaged by moral issues, there's a new story coming up on the greening of religion. So I don't know if you noticed now that the Pope is coming out very strongly in favor of it. And so the story of stewardship within our society becomes more important than the dominance story, the domination of nature. So religions all over the world seem to be reinventing themselves as kind of green narratives about how what's the rightful place of humanity on this planet that God created. There's also another narrative that says that this economic growth that we had for so long doesn't really cut it anymore. People don't get any happier. So what we really need is a description of a society that would make us more, give us a higher quality of life. What's our dream? What's the type of society that we really like to live in? And this, I have a dream type of stories, are very, very important to create a sense of meaning and community and give a deep motivation for moving ahead with the climate action. Mm. And it also is fundamentally not polarizing, if you can frame it in these ways.
That's fantastic. And so to pull all that together, you say that our last thing we need to do is somehow, you know, provide feedback to people, give people signals so that they can, you know, employ all this stuff into their lives. What are some great ways to do that?
Yeah, you know, the climate issue has had some key signals that has been in focus, and that is the ppm values of the atmosphere of CO2. But you know, that's an indicator that people can't relate to, like 400 or 410 or 380, what have you. And also, they've been talking about sea level rise in terms of inches per decade or something like that, which is impossible for people to see. So the whole point is that you need to find indicators and signals that feels relevant to people's responses, not just signals that say something about the global state of the world, but how are we in our society responding? Are we actually starting to turn the curve the right direction? And we can do this on an individual level or a company level or on a city level or a national level, but we should stick to the signals that are comparable across these levels. So for instance, one Norwegian bank are now developing a CO2 bank statement that comes along with your ordinary bank statement. So if you go into your internet bank, you can suddenly see the CO2 impacts of your purchases, for instance. That would give you a monthly feedback on how your consumption plays out in terms of climate emissions. And also, you could easily link that with ads or stories or examples of how it could be improved. So that would be on the personal level. We could also have a look at what we could do in the commercial or corporate level. And we've developed there an indicator that compares how much do you increase your gross profit compared to your emissions. Some people call that for carbon intensity. And the whole point is that previously, industry have heard that the environmentalists and the climate activists are saying, no, we have to stop growth, we have to kill growth. However, the opportunity here is that we can continue the economic growth as long as you also reduce your emissions, and that's actually profitable. And further, it gives a clear signal as to what is a real green growth and what is a typical brown growth. So is your company really a part of the solution or is it part of the problem? That becomes perfectly measurable and clear if we follow this carbon intensity per company indicator. The question that's been driving me all these years is whether humans are, so we say, inevitably short-term.
Right.
And what I've found is a very positive conclusion that we're not inevitably short-term, but we need a little bit help of the social conditions around us. So if we have social norms, supportive frames, simple actions, meaningful stories, and signals that are perceived as personally relevant, then people will actually act for the long term. Mm-hmm. So it's just our culture where we have kind of lost the support. Most other cultures in the history of the earth have had social norms and frames and actions that made it simple for them to behave in line with their ecosystems. And that's just what we have to reestablish in our culture as well.
And that's fantastic, yeah.
That is it for this episode of the You're Not So Smart podcast. To learn more about Per Espen Stoknes, go to his website. It's STOKNES.com, Stoknes.com. Head to BoingBoingPodcast.com for more great podcasts like this one. Go to YouAreNotSoSmart.com for the show notes. And for previous episodes, you can also go to iTunes and Stitcher and SoundCloud for all the previous episodes. The opening music is Clash by Caravan Palace. This music is Banjo Apocalypse. You can find us on Twitter at NotSmartBlog. I'm on Twitter at David McRaney. Facebook, it's just /YouAreNotSoSmart. And as always, you can send your cookie recipes to David at youarenotsosmart.com.